unclean spirit cried out, it left, and they were all amazed, insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, what thing is this? What new doctrine is this? So to them in their day, it was a new doctrine that a man would have the power to command even the unclean spirits and have them obey him. Well, they should have been doing that themselves, but immediately his fame spread abroad because they were dumbfounded about this new doctrine of curing demoniacs by casting out the demons. Mark chapter 4, Christ began again to teach by the seaside. There was gathered a great multitude, and he entered into a ship and sat, and the whole multitude was by to land on the sea. He taught them many things by parables, and said unto them, in his doctrine. So doctrines are conveyed by a lot of these parables as well. And this one's about the sower. Mark chapter 12. Verse 38, part of these doctrines included exposing the wrong and error of wrong churches. Luke 12, verse 38, he said unto them in his doctrine, beware of the scribes. They love to be in long clothing. They love salutation in the marketplace. They love the chief seats in the synagogue. They love the uppermost rooms at feasts. They devour widows' houses. For a pretense they make long prayers. These shall receive greater damnation. And all of that is him saying unto them in his doctrine. So a part of doctrine even includes exposing the people that go around in the name of religion and don't stand up to what that requires to take that name. John chapter 7. Just look at a couple of these in John. And then John 7. About the middle of the feast, the tabernacles, Christ went up into the temple, and the Jews marveled as he's teaching. How does this man know learning, having never been to any of our schools or teachers? Well, Jesus said, my doctrine is not mine, but his acceptance. If any man will do his will, he will know of the doctrine. I'll never forget Dr. Hay at the feast in Squaw Valley one time said, one of the best proofs of the Bible is just find out what it says and see if it brings what it says it'll bring. You know, you want to know if God's, if the Bible's teachings are God's doctrine, just practice it and see what happens to you. And that's what he's saying here. Do God's will. Then you're going to know those doctrines are of God, because look what they produce when you do. Now, you can have four children from the time they're born until they get up to be 20 years old and never spend a penny on them for healing or doctors. Well, I did that. I wasn't lucky. It wasn't just luck. I was obeying God's doctrine. If any man does God's will, he'll know of the doctrine, whether it be of God or whether I speak of myself. Chapter 18. John 18, this time verse 19. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. And he said, I've spoken openly to the world. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard me. Of course, one of them took exception to that and smote Christ. Acts 2, verse 42 is a very basic, valuable, important verse. It shows who sets doctrine in the church. It's not a doctrinal committee. And it's not a SPP. And it's not somebody usurping the apostles' authority. Acts 2, verse 41. Then they that gladly received God's word were baptized. The same day there were added about 3,000 souls. So these newly baptized 3,000 souls continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. God always uses men. You know, they didn't say, well, we got this is of God. We don't have to listen to men. We don't work under men. We don't have any relationship to men like just God, me, and the Bible. You know? They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine.
fellowship, breaking bread, prayers. Acts chapter 5. Here they grabbed the disciples and said, "Didn't we straightly command you that you shouldn't teach in this name? Behold, you fill Jerusalem with your doctrine." So they're teaching with their doctrine. So the word in the New Testament for doctrine is the same word as the word for teaching. Or teaching. Teach. Same verb, same noun. You fill Jerusalem with your teaching, doctrine. So you can substitute the words. Now one verse, Hebrews 6 verse 1, we should note that this is not the same Greek word at all. This is the word logos. Word of Christ, the doctrine. So that's one place in the New Testament you find the word translated doctrine when it should be word or logos. Leaving the principles of the logos, go on to perfection. Now there's another terminology used in the New Testament for a body of doctrine, and that's the term faith, the faith. Now people say, "Well, what faith are you of?" And that's a biblical, legitimate way of phrasing. You might notice Acts 6 and verse 7. The word faith can either mean trust and confidence and belief, or it can mean body of beliefs. Body of trust or confidence. Acts 6 verse 7. The word of God increased, the number of the disciples multiplied in Jerusalem greatly, and a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith. So notice, the way of life, the way of doctrine is called the faith. It's something you're obedient to, the doctrine, to the faith. Acts 13, verse 8. Elymas, the sorcerer, withstood them, seeking to turn away the deputy from the faith, from the way of belief, the way of practice, the way of life, seeking to turn the deputy away from the doctrine, the body of doctrine. Chapter 14, verse 22. Paul says, "Let's go back over the area and strengthen our brethren." Verse 22, they were confirming the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith. Not to continue to have faith, but to continue in the faith, the body of belief, the body of doctrine. Acts 16, verse 5. Now, interestingly enough, you don't find this term anywhere in the gospel, because that's where Christ was establishing the faith. He was laying down the teaching, and then in the book of Acts, they call that body of teaching the faith. Acts 16, verse 5. So were the churches established in the faith, and increased in number daily. And that was by the Jerusalem Conference. Peter made the decision, that's the way the churches were established in the faith, by the apostles setting the doctrine. Now you find the same thing mentioned many times, Titus 3 verse 15, Romans 1 verse 5. Anyway, that should give us enough of the background of the importance of doctrine and what is doctrine. So let's start out on one of the basic doctrines. And this seems to be the logical place to start, because by inventing this doctrine, it leads to several other doctrines. It's kind of like back in Ezekiel 13, we might turn and read this scripture, Ezekiel 13. Beginning verse 10. Because they've seduced my people, saying peace and there was no peace, one built up a wall, lo, others daubed it with untempered mortar. Say to them that daub it with untempered mortar, that it'll fall. There will be an overflowing shower, and you, O great hailstone, shall fall, and a stormy wind shall rend it. Lo, when the wall is fallen, shall it not be said to you, where is the daubing? wherewith you've daubed it. Therefore, thus says the Lord Eternal, I'll even rend it with a stormy wind in my fury. There will be an overflowing shower in mine anger, great hailstones in my fury to consume it. So I'll break down the wall that you've daubed with untempered mortar. I'll bring it down to the ground so that the foundation thereof shall be discovered. So here's this false religion, this false Christianity, this wall of doctrines or beliefs that some have brought out of Hinduism, paganism, all kinds of Egyptian, Babylonian ideas and practices, and then others daub it with mortar, untempered mortar. So people from the time it originated never did prove it. They just whitewashed it, covered it over with more mortar, untempered mortar. So the day is coming when God's going to smash all this wall of false doctrine, and it's going to be obliterated with Christ's coming. I'll break down the wall you've daubed with untempered mortar. I'll bring it down to the ground. The foundation thereof shall be discovered. It'll fall, and you'll be consumed in the midst thereof. And you'll know that I am the Eternal. Thus I'll accomplish my wrath on the wall and on those who've daubed it with untempered mortar. And I'll say to you, the wall is no more, neither they that daubed it, to wit the prophets of Israel, which prophesy concerning Jerusalem in their own eyes and error. So we're going to start off with probably the foundational error about the soul. And whether the soul is mortal or immortal, and what the Bible has to say about the soul. I remember the first time I went to Big Sandy to teach in the college, and I thought, well, I want to just go through every scripture on every subject and just nail those down where there can't be any argument around it forever. And that isn't the way God wrote the Bible. You can't do that. And you can't do that with the word soul. You can't make it mean one thing. It means a number of things. So you can search all you want, and you can't nail down any one meaning of the word soul. And what most people don't realize about the doctrine of the soul is that if you took a concordance and you looked up the word soul, you'd get primarily what those 1611 translators wanted you to get. Listen to this about the word soul. In the Old Testament, the word nephesh, which we all should know, N-E-P-H-E-S-H, nephesh, occurs 754 times in the Hebrew Old Testament. Each occurrence is, you have to know that the original word nephesh is there, or you wouldn't know that is one of the places where it's used. For example, out of 754 times it's in the Hebrew, 472 times you'll find a soul in English. What is it all those other times then? You know, only 472 out of 754 is translated soul. Now listen to this. In the other 282 places, it's represented by 44 different words. Or phrases. 44 different words or phrases in that other 282 places of Nephesh Hebrew is there. If that isn't enough to discourage you, you ought to wait till you get into the New Testament and see how many ways it's translated. You know, what most people don't know, the Hebrew word Nephesh is used of the lower animals four times before God ever uses it about man. And that's a significant number, you know, the number of God revealing himself, number four. So four times before God ever used nephesh about man, he used it about critters, creatures, animals. So we're soul brothers with animals. That's right. You know, if you get the Hebrew terminology, we're soul brothers with the animals. Now let's take a look at those four places. Genesis chapter 1, and you ought to note these in your Bible, so anybody wants to hassle you about an immortal soul, you're ready to give an answer to anybody that asks you. Genesis 1, verse 20. God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has soul, naphesh. That's what the word life there ought to be. So, moving creatures have naphesh. So I guess they're going to go to heaven or hell too. They got souls. They're going to come back as cows, I guess, if they live a good life. Now, if you're a good crocodile, you can come back as a monkey, I guess, and get higher on the evolutionary tree. Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creatures. So all these moving creatures that are in the waters have souls. Now, verse 21, God created great whales and every living creature. The word creature is the word naphesh. So God created great naphesh. Now, if the word naphesh, soul, by itself, means ever-living immortal, why on earth they put the word living in front of it here? Because the Hebrew word ki is the word living. Can you imagine talking about the living immortal soul? Well, if it's immortal, it is living. You don't need to double talk or stutter there, you know. Every living ki, naphesh, that moves, which the waters brought forth abundance. All right, now verse 24. God said, let the earth bring forth the living naphesh. Same term again as we read chapter verse 21. Now, not only did waters bring forth living naphesh, but now the earth brought forth living ki naphesh. And those ki naphesh's are after a kind. Cattle ki naphesh's and creeping things and beasts, and they're all ki living naphesh's. Alright? Verse 30. To every beast of the earth, to every fowl of the air, to everything that creeps upon the earth, wherein there is naphesh. Well, in that case, it just means the life essence of these creatures. To every beast of the earth, it's naphesh that makes them alive. To every fowl of the air, it's naphesh that makes them alive. Wherein there's life, I've given every green herb for me. And when you think about the doctrine of the soul and the effect that it's had on mankind, let's maybe read first of all in a here's a good way to appear intellectual and cloud up the muddy waters. And this is the Younger Bible Dictionary on the article about soul. Now, see how plain truth this is, how clear this is. Soul. Generally, the rendering of the Hebrew naphesh, a breathing creature, Greek souche, breath, and so forth, the equivalent of naphesh. The Hebrew term may indicate not only the entire inner nature of man, but also his entire personality, all that pertains to the person of man, in the sense of person, somebody, everybody. So he shows the Hebrew word naphesh can even be translated somebody and everybody. And if you say 18 souls came out of Egypt, so even numbers are reckoned as souls, as well in the New Testament as they are in the Old. 1 Peter 3, verse 20. It would thence be wrongly concluded that the soul is what constitutes the person of man. For the brute is also called naphesh. In naphesh, in itself, is not involved the conception of the personal living, but only of the self-living. You think that's nutty? Wait. In such cases, naphesh indicates the person of the man, but not the man as the person. The beast is naphesh as a self-living nature by the power of the Spirit that proceeds from God and pervades the entire nature. The individual constitution of which spirit is the soul of the brute. But man is nephesh, as a self-living nature by the power of the spirit that proceeds from God, and is in the form of God, and is therefore personal, the operation of which spirit is his endowment with soul. Now, if you get all that, explain that to me after class tonight. That's as clear as mud. The Greek term psuche has the simple meaning of life. That in which there is life, a living being, every soul or every one. It also has the meaning of the seat of the feelings, the desires, the affections, the aversions, like our word heart or soul. The Revised Version almost uniformly soul. The human soul, insofar as it is so constituted, that by the right use of aids offered it by God, it can attain its highest end and secure eternal blessedness, the soul regarded as a moral being designed for everlasting life. Another meaning of psuche is the soul as an essence, which differs from the body and is not dissolved by death. The soul freed from the body, a disembodied soul. Space doesn't permit them to tell you any more than all that. Same argument. Now, can you imagine that's all they have in a whole Bible dictionary on the foundational doctrine of Christianity? You know, you can't believe in a heaven and hell till you get a soul. You got to have an immortal soul in order to have one to go somewhere forever. So, you know, once you invent an immortal soul, then you daub untempered marble about going to heaven and hell and God being a Trinity and all the others. You know, they just kind of are untempered martyr daubed onto this first lie about man having an immortal soul. So now you can send him somewhere forever, you know. And the fact that some people get away with the good life of sin in this world requires God to make them live forever so he can punish them enough in the next life. You know, death isn't enough punishment for people that live wickedly. You know, if death's all the punishment there is, then everybody gets the same punishment, no matter how wicked you are. So there has to be another place, you know, where God gets you more. And hell ought to have more compartments then, because, you know, some ought to have it worse there than others. So if little kids die, you got to have a little kid hell. And if the old patriarchs died, you know, before hell was brought up in the New Testament, you have to have a hell for the padres, the old people, you know, the fathers. And boy, there's no end to the ideas. Let me read a little bit out of the Golden Bough by George Frazer. This shows you what a harmless doctrine, like the immortality of the soul, can do. What does early man understand by death? To what causes does he attribute death? How does he think death may be guarded against? As the savage commonly explains the processes of inanimate nature by supposing that they're produced by living beings working in or behind the phenomena, so he explains the phenomena of life itself. If an animal lives and moves, it can only be, he thinks, because there's a little animal inside which moves it. Like somebody in a gorilla suit. It can't do anything at all. All right. By the same human reasoning, if a man lives and moves, it can only be because he has a little man or animal inside who moves him. The animal inside the animal, the man inside the man, is the soul. And as the activity of an animal or a man is explained by the presence of the soul, so the repose or sleep or death is explained by its absence. Sleep or trance being the temporary, death being the permanent absence of the soul. Hence, if death be the permanent absence of the soul, the way to guard against it is either to prevent the soul from leaving the body, or if it does depart, to ensure that it shall return. The precautions adopted by savages to secure one or other of these ends take the form of certain prohibitions or taboos, which are nothing but rules intended to ensure either the continued presence or the return of the soul. In short, they're life preservers or lifeguards. Addressing some Australian blacks, the European missionary said, "I'm not one as you think, but two." Now imagine how much these missionaries help clear the air, you know. And so the missionary arrives and says, "I'm not one as you think, but two." Upon this, these natives laugh. He said, "You may laugh as much as you like," the missionary continued. "I tell you that I am two in one. This great body that you see is one. Within that there's another little one, which is not visible. The great body dies and is buried, but the little body flies away when the great one dies." To this, some of the blacks replied, "Yes, yes, we also are two. We also have a little body within the breast." On being asked where the little body went after death, some said it went behind the bush. Others said it went into the sea. Some said they didn't know. Which no missionary would ever say, you know. The Hurons thought that the soul had a head and body, arms and legs. In short, that it was a complete little model of the man himself. So I guess if you get an arm cut off, you lost part of your soul then or something. The Eskimo believe that the soul exhibits the same shape as the body it belongs to, but is of a more subtle and ethereal nature. According to the Nootkas, the soul has the shape of a tiny man. Its seat is in the crown of the head. So long as it stands erect, its owner is hale and hearty. But when from any cause it loses its upright position, he loses his senses. Among the Indian tribes of the lower Fraser River, man is held to have four souls, of which the principal one has the form of a mannequin. The Malays conceive the human soul as a little man, mostly invisible, and of the bigness of a thumb, who corresponds exactly in shape, proportion, and even in complexion to the man in whose body he resides. This mannequin is of a thin, unsubstantial nature, though not so impalpable that it may cause displacement on entering a physical object, and it can flit quickly from place to place. It's temporarily absent from the body in sleep, or a trance, or a disease, and permanently absent after death. So exact is the resemblance of the mannequin to the man, in other words, of the soul to the body, that as there are fat bodies and thin bodies, so there are fat souls and thin souls. So there are heavy bodies and light bodies, long bodies and short bodies. So there are heavy souls and light souls, long souls and short souls. The people of Neos think that every man, before he is born, is asked how long or how heavy a soul he'd like. And a soul of the desired weight or length is measured out to him. The heaviest soul ever given out weighs about 10 grams. The length of a man's life is proportioned to the length of his soul. Children who die young just have short souls. The Fijian conception of the soul as a tiny human being comes clearly out in the customs observed at the death of a chief among the Nakilo tribe. When a chief dies, certain men who are the hereditary undertakers call him as he lies oiled and ornamented on fine mats, saying, "Rise, sir, the chief, and let us be going. The day has come over the land." Then they conduct him to the riverside, and you've seen these in the engravings on the tombs in Egypt, the god of the dead, you know, escorting this man down the river of life to the other side. Then they conduct him to the riverside where the ghostly ferryman comes to ferry Nakilo ghost across the stream. As they thus attend the chief on his last journey, they hold their great fans close to the ground to shelter him, because, as one of them explained to a missionary, his soul is only a little child. People in the Punjab who tattoo themselves believe that at death, the soul, the little entire man or woman inside the mortal frame, will go to heaven blazoned with the same tattoo patterns that adorn the body in life. Sometimes, however, as we'll see, the human soul is conceived not in human but in animal form. The soul is commonly supposed to escape by the natural openings of the body, especially the mouth and nostrils. So when somebody sneezes, their breath went out of them, and you say gazoonite, in other words, go back in there, soul, or God bless you and let your soul go back in, otherwise you're a dead duck. In the Celebes, they sometimes fasten fish hooks to a sick man's nose or navel or feet, so that if his soul should try to escape, it may be hooked and held fast. A Turek on the Baram River in Borneo refused to part with some hook-like stones, because they, as it were, hooked his soul to his body, and so prevented the spiritual portion of him from becoming detached from the material. When a seed diet, sorcerer, or medicine man is initiated, his fingers are supposed to be furnished with fish hooks, with which he will thereafter clutch the human soul in the act of flying away, and restore it to the body of the sufferer. But hooks, it is claimed, may be used to catch the souls of enemies, as well as of friends. Acting on this principle, headhunters in Borneo hang wooden hooks beside the skulls of their slain enemies, in the belief that this helps them on their forays to hook in fresh heads. One of the implements of a Haida medicine man is a hollow bone, in which he bottles up departing souls, and so restores them to their owners. When anyone in their presence yawns, the Hindus always snap their thumbs, believing that this will hinder the soul from issuing through the open mouth. The Marcasans used to hold the mouth and nose of a dying man in order to keep him in life by preventing his soul from escaping. That sounds like they're doing something else for you there. If they hold your mouth and nose, they help you, you know. That doesn't keep your life from parting. And the same custom is reported of the New Caledonians, and with the like intention, the Bagobas of the Philippine Islands put rings of brass wire on the wrists or anklets of their sick. On the other hand, the Epinomas of South America seal up the eyes, nose, and mouth of a dying person in case his ghost should get out and carry off others. And for a similar reason, the people of Nias, who fear the spirits of the recently deceased and identify them with the breath, seek to confine the vagrant soul in its earthly tabernacle by bunging up the nose or tying up the jaws of the carts. Before leaving the carts, the Wakalbura of Australia used to place hot coals in its ears in order to keep the ghosts in the body until they had got such a good start that he couldn't overtake them. In the southern Celebes, to hinder the escape of a woman's soul in childbirth, the nurse ties a band as tightly as possible around the body of the expectant mother. It's kind of obvious how many of these things are demons taking advantage of human ignorance about belief. You know, one of these days we might find out how many people have been killed off trying to keep them from dying. The Manakabauers of Sumatra observe a similar custom. A skein of thread or a string is sometimes fastened around the wrist or loins of a woman in childbirth, so that when her soul seeks to depart in her hour of travail, it may find the egress barred. Unless the soul of a babe should escape and be lost as soon as it's born, the Alfors of the Celebes, when a birth is about to take place, they're careful to close every opening in the house, even the keyhole. And they stop up every chink and cranny in the wall. Also, they tie up the mouths of all animals inside and outside the house, for fear one of them might swallow the child's soul. For a similar reason, all persons present in the house, even the mother herself, are obliged to keep their mouths shut the whole time the birth is taking place. When the question was put, why they didn't hold their noses also, lest the child's soul should get into one of them, the answer was that breath being exhaled as well as inhaled through the nostrils, the soul would be expelled before it could have time to settle down. Popular expressions in the language of civilized peoples, such as to have one's heart in one's mouth, or the soul on the lips or in the nose, show how natural is the idea that the life or soul may escape by the mouth or nostrils. Often the soul is conceived as a bird ready to take flight. This conception has probably left traces in most languages, and it lingers as a metaphor in poetry. The Malays carry out the conception of the bird soul in a number of odd ways. If the soul is a bird on the wing, it may be attracted by light, and so either prevented from flying away or lured back from its perilous flight. Thus in Java, when a child is placed on the ground for the first time, a moment which uncultured people seem to regard as especially dangerous, it's put in a hen coop, and the mother makes a clucking sound as if she were calling him. And in Sinsang, a district of Borneo, when a person, man, woman, or child, has fallen out of a house or off a tree and has been brought home, knocked the breath out of him, his wife or other kinswoman goes as speedily as possible to the spot where the accident happened, screws life, which has been colored yellow, while she utters the words, cluck, cluck, soul, so-and-so's in his house again, cluck, cluck, soul.
That, and that's the claim, he lost his soul and his breath got knocked out of him. So the way to get it back is just scatter that rice up there and get that soul back, you know.
Then she gathers up the rice in a basket, carries it to the sufferer, drops the grains from her hand on his head, saying again, cluck, cluck, soul. Here the intention clearly is to decoy back the loitering bird soul and replace it in the head of its owner. The soul of a sleeper is supposed to wander away from his body and actually to visit the place, to see the person, and to perform the acts of which he dreams. When an Indian of Brazil or Guyana wakes up from a sound sleep, he's firmly convinced that his soul has really been away hunting, fishing, felling trees, or whatever else he's dreamed of doing, while all the time his body has been lying motionless in his hammock. The whole Bororo village has been thrown into a panic and nearly deserted because somebody had dreamed that he saw enemies stealthily approaching. A Macusi Indian in weak health, who dreamed that his employer had made him haul the canoe up a series of difficult cataracts, bitterly reproached his master the next morning for his want of consideration in thus making a poor invalid go out and toil during the night. The Indians of the Gran Chaco are often heard to relate the most incredible stories as things which they've themselves seen and heard. Hence, strangers who do not know them intimately say in their haste that these Indians are liars. In point of fact, the Indians are firmly convinced of what they relate, for these wonderful adventures are simply their dreams which they do not distinguish from waking reality. Now, the absence of the soul in sleep has its dangers. For if from any cause the soul should be permanently detained away from the body, the person thus deprived of the vital principle must die. There's a German belief that the soul escapes from the sleeper's mouth in the form of a white mouse or a little bird, and that to prevent the return of the bird or animal would be fatal to the sleeper. Hence, in Transylvania, they say that you should not let a child sleep with its mouth open, or its soul will slip out in the shape of a mouse and the child will never wake. Many causes may detain the sleeper's soul. Thus, his soul may meet the soul of another sleeper, and the two souls may fight. If a Guinea Negro wakens with sore bones in the morning, he thinks that his soul has been thrashed by another soul in sleep. Or it may meet the soul of a person just deceased and be carried off by it. Hence, in the Aru Islands, the inmates of a house will not sleep the night after a death has taken place in it, because the soul of the deceased is supposed to be still in the house and they fear to meet it in a dream. Imagine all this just because you say there's an immortal soul. Boy, oh boy, the poor people that have suffered because of a lying doctrine like that. Again, the soul of the sleeper may be prevented by an accident or by physical force from returning to his body. When a Dayak dreams of falling into the water, he supposes that this accident has really befallen his spirit, and he sends for a wizard who fishes for the spirit with a hand net in a basin of water till he catches it and restores it to its owner. The sand calls tell how a man fell asleep, growing very thirsty. His soul, in the form of a lizard, left his body and entered a pitcher of water to drink. Just then, the owner of the pitcher happened to cover it, so the soul couldn't return to the body, and the man died. While his friends were preparing to burn the body, someone uncovered the pitcher to get water. The lizard thus escaped and returned to the body, which immediately revived. So the man rose up and asked his friends why they were weeping. They told him they thought he was dead. They were about to burn his body. He said he'd been down a well to get water, but had found it hard to get out and had just returned. So they saw it all. It's a common rule with primitive people not to waken a sleeper. Some of you husbands can bar this. Because his soul is away and might not have time to get back. So if the man awakened without his soul, he falls sick. If it's absolutely necessary to rouse the sleeper, it must be done very gradually to allow the soul time to return. The pigeon and the cuckoo, suddenly awakened from a nap by somebody treading on his foot, has been heard bawling after his soul and imploring it to return. He'd just been dreaming that he was far away in Congo. Great was his alarm on suddenly waking to find his body in Matuku. Death stared him in the face unless his soul could be induced to speed at once across the sea and reanimate its deserted tenement. The man would probably have died of fright if the missionary hadn't been at hand to allay his terror. Still more dangerous is it, in the opinion of primitive man, to move a sleeper or alter his position or his appearance. For if this were done, the soul on its return might not be able to find or recognize its body, and so the person would die. The Manankabauers deem it highly improper to blacken or dirty the face of the sleeper, lest the absent soul should shrink from re-entering a body thus disfigured. The Thani Malays fancy that if a person's face be painted while he sleeps, the soul which has gone out of him will not recognize him, and he will sleep on till his face is washed. In Bombay, it's thought equivalent to murder to change the aspect of the sleeper, as by painting his face in fantastic colors or giving mustaches to a sleeping woman. For when the soul returns, it'll not know its own body, and the person will die. But in order that a man's soul should quit his body, it's not necessary that he should be asleep. It may quit him in his waking hours, and then sickness, insanity, or death will be the result. Thus, a man of the Wurundjeri tribe in Australia lay at his last gasp because his spirit had departed from him. The medicine man went in pursuit, caught the spirit by the middle, just as it was about to plunge into the sunset glow, which is the light cast by the souls of the dead as they pass in and out of the underworld where the sun goes to rest. Having captured the vagrant spirit, the doctor brought it back under his possum rug, laid himself down on the dying man, put the soul back into him so that after a time he revived. The Karens of Burma are perpetually anxious about their souls, lest these should go roving from their bodies, leaving the owners to die. When a man has reason to fear that his soul is about to take this fatal step, a ceremony is performed to retain or recall it, in which the whole family has to take part. A meal is prepared, consisting of a cock and hen, a special kind of rice, and a bunch of bananas. Then the head of the family takes the bowl, which is used to skim rice, and knocking with it 3 times on the top of the house ladder, says, "Bro, come back, soul. Do not tarry outside. If it rains, you'll be wet. If the sun shines, you'll be hot. The gnats will sting you, the leeches will bite you, the tigers will devour you, the thunder will crush you. Bro, come back, soul. Here it'll be well with you. You'll want for nothing. Come and eat under shelter from the wind and the storm." After that, the family partakes of the meal. The ceremony ends with everybody tying their right wrist with a string, which has been charmed by a sorcerer. Similarly, the Lolos of southwestern China believe that the soul leaves the body in chronic illness. In that case, they read a sort of elaborate litany calling on the soul by name and beseeching it to return from the hills, the vales, the rivers, the forests, the fields, or from wherever it may be straying. At the same time, cups of water, wine, and rice are set at the door for the refreshment of the weary, wandering spirit. When the ceremony is over, they tie a red cord round the arm of the sick man to tether the soul. Well, he goes on and on and on with pages and pages of observations he made while investigating all these doctrines of these various tribes of the world. But can you imagine all that coming because somebody gave him the idea that man's an immortal soul? Well, you know, there's a statement back in the 2nd chapter of Hebrews that shows modern man and Christianity has done the same thing. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14. "For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that has the talent.